Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Anne Ball, and John Russell. Later, Marcia James will bring us this week's People in America report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Japanese troops arrived in South Sudan this week to join a United Nations peacekeeping force. The troops are replacing a group of Japanese peacekeepers who served in the UN mission in South Sudan. The main job for the 350 Japanese soldiers will be to help build roads or other infrastructure in the country. They are also under orders to use force if needed. The earlier Japanese peacekeepers were not permitted to use force. Last year, Japan's government approved legislation to expand the duties of its military members deployed overseas. Under the measure, Japanese troops can use force to protect themselves and other civilians. They are permitted to act on calls for help from people working for UN agencies or aid groups. There are also plans to let the Japanese troops guard UN bases. Some bases have been attacked in South Sudan's civil war. Military officials say all the Japanese troops will be in the country by the middle of December. It is the first time that Japanese peacekeeping forces will be permitted to use force while on duty since World War II. The violence in South Sudan started in December 2013. The clashes are between forces supporting President Salva Kiir and those loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The two sides reached a peace deal in 2015, but fighting restarted in July when forces loyal to Machar launched an attack on the presidential palace in Juba, the capital. The fighting is largely happening along ethnic lines. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. The war has damaged South Sudan's economy and created a humanitarian crisis. More than 2 million people have been displaced, and nearly 5 million are believed to be lacking necessary food. There are more than 12,000 UN peacekeepers in South Sudan. The UN mission there has faced criticism for failing to protect civilians. In July, two Chinese peacekeepers died and 5 others were wounded after their vehicle was attacked in Juba. Critics of Japan's deployment say the move violates the country's anti-war constitution. Some fear the new powers permitting troops to use force could bring Japan's military into overseas conflicts. But Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has argued that the broader mandate gives Japan the ability to respond to growing regional threats. Abe spoke about the new duties of Japanese troops during an appearance with a parliamentary committee earlier this year. South Sudan cannot assure its peace and stability on its own, and for that reason, a UN peacekeeping operation is being conducted, he said. Abe added that the Japanese forces will be carrying out activities that only it can do in a tough environment. I'm Brian Lynn.
The election may be over, but for President-elect Donald Trump, the work is just beginning. The President-elect's transition team now needs to choose who will work in his administration. In all, there are about 4,000 jobs in the executive branch of the U.S. federal government. They include everything from top-level advisors and cabinet members to ambassadors, agency directors, and people who answer the telephones. Dorrance Smith knows about working at the White House. The former senior White House advisor has worked there 2 times for Republican presidents Gerald Ford and George Bush. Later, he was a senior advisor at the Defense Department for President George W. Bush. Smith says filling all those jobs is not as easy as saying, I want this person in this job. The Federal Bureau of Investigation and government lawyers first must investigate them.
They will go through your background for the past 20 years to determine whether or not you are fit to serve. And you also are going to have to reveal publicly, as a public servant, your assets, and many people would prefer not to have that be public information.
If the person has financial investments in a related area, they may have to sell them before taking the job. Traditionally, the incoming White House team hires people from their party who have worked at the top levels of government. However, Donald Trump is different. He ran a campaign that was not traditional. Smith says there are Republicans who do not want to work in Trump's administration. Before the election, Trump did not have as many people working on a transition plan as Democrat Hillary Clinton. Sources say she had more people chosen for government jobs. Presidential elections mean big changes for many workers in the executive branch of the U.S. government. In 1992, George Bush was not reelected, so Dorrance Smith had to decide what to do when he left the White House in January. That same year, Democratic congressional official John Angel was moving to the White House. His boss, Leon Panetta, had been named head of the White House Budget Office. Angel explains, after the president's inauguration speech and parade are over, he walks into the Oval Office of the White House. Then, he is in charge of one of the world's largest organizations. For Angel, getting ready for that day meant many meetings in Washington to prepare a new budget for the Clinton presidency. It is a very stressful process, he says. As a government official with many years of experience, both in Congress and the White House, Angel says he thinks Trump is facing a very difficult transition. That is because of his lack of government experience. As a former top congressional official, Angel says Trump faces hard choices about cutting government and cutting programs that are popular with Americans. Trump will be working with a Republican Congress. Some members will have their own ideas about what to cut and what to keep. What will happen next in the current presidential transition is hard to predict. Smith says Trump's campaign and election blew up all of the models. The Trump transition team will work on filling those 4,000 jobs. I'm Ann Ball.
Selfie, taking a picture of yourself to post on social media, became an official word in the Oxford Dictionary in 2013. The idea seems simple. Just pose and snap a photo of yourself with your cell phone camera. How difficult could that be? But in 2014, a reported 15 people died while taking selfies. That number has risen each year since then. 39 deaths connected to selfies were reported in 2015. And this year has seen more than 70 such deaths. Researchers from universities in the U.S. and India have released findings from the first study of deaths due to selfies. The investigators examined the causes and characteristics of the deaths. The researchers found that people who take selfies for sharing on social media often have narcissistic tendencies. The report says these people use selfies as a form of self-identification and expression. They may take selfies in more dangerous settings because they seek greater attention. These dangerous situations can lead to injury and even death. The researchers define a selfie death as death of an individual or a group of people that could have been avoided had the individual not been taking a selfie. One example of a dangerous selfie in the study involved bicycle races. People sometimes get on the track to take a picture of themselves with the racing bicycles behind them. Crashes and injuries have resulted. Another example described people standing on train tracks trying to get a selfie as a train moves toward them from behind. The most common cause of selfie death was falling from high places. It caused 32 of the 172 deaths during the last 2.5 years. Drowning was another common cause of death. Other risk factors include transportation, such as taking a selfie while walking on train tracks or driving a car. Taking a selfie near electric lines also led to some of the deaths, as did selfies taken with weapons and wild animals. India reported 76 selfie deaths, the most of the countries studied. And it might be more dangerous to be a man with a smartphone. Although women take more selfies, males were far more likely to die during selfies. 75.5% of the reported deaths were of men. About one-third of the 172 reported selfie deaths had a single death, while 24 incidents involved the deaths of groups. Two of the incidents killed 7 people each. Efforts are growing to prevent these deaths. The study says there are now 16 places in Mumbai, India, established as no-selfie zones. The Russian government also has started a Safe Selfies campaign to warn people about risky selfies. The website Selfie to Die For asks visitors to take a promise not to risk their lives and the lives of others while taking selfies. The website also has tips for staying safe while taking selfies and gives examples of people who died from taking risky selfies. Their Twitter account, @SelfieToDieFor, offers tips for staying safe while taking selfies and reports incidents of selfie deaths and injuries. I'm John Russell.
The U.S. Thanksgiving holiday is symbolized by its traditional food, a large bird we call a turkey. But turkey is certainly not from Turkey. In fact, its English name is based on one big mistake. We could say it is a case of mistaken identity. Let's set the record straight. The word Turkey has meant the land of the Turks since ancient times. The word turkey, as it refers to the bird, first appeared in the English language in the mid-1500s. The misunderstanding over the word happened because of two similar-looking kinds of birds. There is an African bird called the guinea fowl. It has dark feathers with white spots and a patch of brown on the back of its neck. Portuguese traders brought the guinea fowl to Europe through North Africa. This foreign bird came to Europe through Turkish lands. So the English thought of the bird as a Turkish chicken. When Europeans came to North America, they saw a bird that looked like the guinea fowl. This bird was native to the North American continent. Orrin Hargraves is a lexicographer, someone who writes dictionaries. Hargraves explains what happened. Some Europeans saw an American turkey, thought that it was the guinea fowl, which at the time was called the turkey cock, and so gave it the same name. Hundreds of years later, we continue to call this North American bird turkey, even though it has no connection at all with the country Turkey, or even with Europe. But English is not the only language with interesting and even questionable names for this North American bird. The Turkish, for their part, call turkey Hindi, the Turkish name for India. The reference to India probably comes from the old, wrong idea that the New World was in Eastern Asia. The French call it dend, a name that also connects the bird to India. Dend means from India in the French language. Turkey has similar names in several other languages. So, what do they call this North American bird in India? In the Hindi language, turkey is tarki. But wait, there's more. In Portuguese, the same bird is called peru, after the South American nation. Thanks to our VOA Learning English Facebook friends, we have a few more names for turkey to share with you. The Vietnamese word for the bird is gà tai, or Western chicken. Our Facebook friend Nguyen Duc explains that local chicken is smaller than Western chicken. A Facebook friend in Myanmar explained that the Burmese word for turkey is giat sain. The name translates to elephant chicken in English. That animal looks like a big chicken, Zhao Miao Wen explained. The Dari language name for the bird, Phil Mur, also translates to elephant chicken. Abdullah Kaver explained to us that, here in Afghanistan, this name represents the size of this delicious meal. He adds that he thinks the descriptive name elephant chicken is better than a country name.
Every year, billions of kilograms of fresh produce are wasted in the United States. The food ends up in landfills, producing harmful greenhouse gases. Meanwhile, millions of poor Americans go hungry, without access to healthy, affordable meals. Evan Lutz is passionate about correcting that social injustice, and he combines that goal with a passion for business.
My entire life, I've wanted to become a social entrepreneur, not just starting a business that made money, but also one that gave back. You know, I'm just an average guy with, like I said, I'm just an average guy with a passion towards making sure no food goes to waste and making sure no person's ever hungry in America, and I want to do that through business.
Lutz is CEO and founder of Hungry Harvest. Hungry Harvest is a business which collects and sells ugly produce. These are fruits and vegetables that most food companies would throw away. Lutz says more than 6 billion pounds are wasted each year due to surface imperfections and processing inefficiencies.
So I'll give you an example. If you go in a grocery store and walk down the aisle and see all the produce lined up, shiny, perfect, same size, same color, you might notice that everything, you know, if you go to a farm, right, everything doesn't grow the same way on a farm, but if you go to a grocery store, everything is growing the same exact way, right? So all that stuff that doesn't grow the same exact way also oftentimes gets wasted, gets thrown out. And so we take all that stuff that normally would get thrown out because it's too big, too small, and not size or shape. We box it up into our variety boxes and we deliver it to our customers once a week.
Lutz established Hungry Harvest in 2014. Its success depends on teamwork.
Every week on Monday and Tuesday, we'll decide the contents of the box, which are going in the next week's box, right? So we'll call up farmers, we'll work with packing houses and wholesalers to give them calls, shoot them emails, shoot them texts even, or do in-person visits to see what they have available that would normally be getting thrown away that week, right? We place the order when we can accurately project how many customers and how many boxes we'll have that weekend, right? And so that's the process on Thursdays. And on Fridays, we'll actually make the boxes for Saturdays. Saturdays, we'll make the boxes for Sundays. Sundays, we'll make the boxes for Mondays. And all of those days, we'll do deliveries. So Saturdays, We'll send out drivers. They'll come to our warehouse and make deliveries.
For every purchase and delivery, Hungry Harvest donates healthy food to needy people. Hungry Harvest has recovered 300,000 pounds of produce to date and provided 100,000 pounds to those in need. Lutz was inspired to act after seeing extreme poverty in areas of Baltimore, Maryland. He says he wants to eliminate the so-called food desert in that area.
Our plan for 2016 is actually to eliminate a food desert in Baltimore. Now, how we're going to do that, we already have the infrastructure in place. We have drivers that make deliveries to our customers every single week. We have an assembly line. We can use recovered boxes. And really what we want to do is have access to certain areas of Baltimore to fresh produce for really cheap. And we'll work on accepting EBT and WIC and food stamps by the end of the year. So people will go on, and in these food deserts, we'll be able to go online, pay a reduced price for those boxes, and we'll have volunteers then actually assemble and deliver the boxes for us. And that's how you eliminate a food desert, grant people access to healthy, affordable foods.
In January 2016, Lutz appeared on the American Business Competition television show, Shark Tank. It connects investors with entrepreneurs. Lutz sought a $50,000 investment in Hungry Harvest in exchange for a 5% stake in his company. He got even more than he expected, $100,000 for 10% ownership. Lutz is using the money to expand. Right now, consumers can receive produce from Hungry Harvest in Maryland, Virginia, Philadelphia, and the District of Columbia.
So we want to be the largest produce delivery service on the East Coast in 5 years and the largest in the United States in 10 years. And we want to do that with a purpose of reducing food from going to waste and feeding hungry families. Like I said, there are 6 billion pounds of produce that go to waste every single year. How amazing would it be if we can reduce 1 billion pounds of that from going to waste and give that to our customers and donate that to hungry families, right? Or if there are 50 million people that are food insecure, what if we could eliminate that and make it 25 million people that are food insecure in the next 10 years? That's the impact that I think this model can make. And that's exactly what we plan to do over the next 10 years.
For Evan Lutz, giving back to others came from his upbringing.
When I was growing up, my parents instilled in me the values of giving back, and giving is a lot more powerful than receiving. And so I wanted to bring that to life when I was fulfilling my career dreams, which was being an entrepreneur.
Lutz says Hungry Harvest has turned that hope into a reality.
Well, I live, breathe, and literally eat Hungry Harvest. So this is my entire life. I'm not unsatisfied at all, not having a life outside of Hungry Harvest. This is what I do, and I love what I do. It's a dream come true.
But Evan Lutz now has even bigger dreams for Hungry Harvest. Why not end food waste and hunger in America?
We sell produce with purpose, and that doesn't just mean we reduce food from going to waste. It doesn't just mean we give back to the community in terms of donations and feeding the hungry. It doesn't just mean we hire people that are getting back on their feet. We hire people that were formerly in prison. We hire people that were formerly injured or were sick, that are living in homeless shelters, that are really looking to get back on their feet and for a second chance in life. And so we live by this mantra of we want to live a life of purpose. And we do that, we just happen to sell fruits and vegetables. So everything we do has a social purpose, has a social impact in Hungry Harvest. And that is reflected in how we live our daily life. And we're really happy to be fulfilling a great mission and to be doing something that's really sustainable and that we think can really revolutionize the food industry in America.
I'm Marcia James.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.